Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
Here's my quote for 2025. Let's see if I can find it. This was Joseph Campbell. We must be willing to let go of the life we planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us.
Nice.
Yeah. Well, but yeah, but you don't abandon the plan, or you don't realize the plan is wrong without fomenting it in the first place. That's part of it.
I wouldn't assume wrongness, but I would be open, right? Just open and curious.
So the one I had, I really like Joe's though, is from Tom's list, and it's measure your progress in units of willingness instead of willpower, with degrees of self-acceptance rather than change.
Genius.
They both sound great to me.
The nutshell you read is about intention and effort. I have positive intention, and I'm making the effort. It's like, because I've spent much time in my life, you know, having decent intention and not making effort.
What stuck out to me was it foregrounds the relationship with yourself through the process rather than this focus on outcomes necessarily, or, you know, my progress has more to do with, you know, with acceptance than with some external marker.
Right. That's what I meant to say. Yeah.
I don't know what you meant to say.
That's what I meant to say.
You're funny. That's exactly what I meant. Well,
that's
done.
Exactly it, wasn't it? You know, what it reminds me of is what we've talked about all along, right? Is the focus on, when we go back to the serenity prayer, you know, what can we change and what can't we change, right? What's within our...
Comes
back to it. Yeah. So it's back to this thing. I'm a big fan of John Wooden, that famous UCLA basketball coach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the things that he observed, which is right in line with this, is when a new player would come on the team, he'd spend a lot of time helping that player understand what success means. And he felt like he had to deprogram a lot of the players, because for success for a lot of the players had to do with outcome, whether we win the game or not. And what he realized was that was a mistake, that put the focus, that created pressure, that put a focus on something you can't control. What he did is he said success to, and this is what he taught his players, success is when you show up and you give your best effort. And if you go out there and give your best effort and have the best attitude you can have when you played, regardless of what the score is, you're a winner. That's what he said. And that's that same idea that Tom is talking about. It's how we show up in our life that matters. And we say this all the time. It's not the experience we're having. It's our relationship to it.
There's places along the way in the game, so to speak, is that where we are going to have the option of giving up because we are not going to be able to succeed. With you know, so present tense. And what Wooden is talking about is the idea is I can, no matter what I've done up to this point, in this next minute, I can succeed.
Yeah, see, that's the freedom. See, that's what almost.
Yeah, I can refocus. I can, you know, and I can do it now. Yeah.
It's to be liberated from the outcome. You know, that's what we're talking about, is freedom is liberation from the outcome. Bill called it a true independence of spirit. What we're doing is not dependent on what is going to happen. It's dependent on how we're meeting that experience, how we're showing up.
Exactly. I have a photograph in the next room where some, I don't know who gave it to me, but somebody, it's a scoreboard of the Vanderbilt a football game, and the score is like something like 65-0, and Vanderbilt's losing that much, and it's like and it's 2 seconds are left on the clock for the whole thing, and the thing at the very tip says go offense. I mean, it's
amazing.
Beautiful.
That's like something you would have written.
I wish I had. It was, but I mean, it really happened at a game. Somebody took a picture of it. It was beautiful.
That's great. That's wonderful.
One of the things for me is to really understand what effort is, because sometimes I think I'm exhausted because I think I'm doing the work. I'm ruminating, you know, I'm becoming righteously indignant, and like, I don't actually lift a finger to do anything, right? It, you know, if it's political, like I read all of the stuff and watch all of the news and I yell at the screen, but never go and find a candidate that I want to volunteer for a day, right? Like, and I feel like I've been doing the work. I know this stuff, right? And the same is true with AA, right? I can be, you know, the bleacher creature that's pointing a finger and saying this has to change and that has to change. That's not doing the work, right? But I feel like, you know, I what more can I do?
It's certainly taxing.
I've ruminated all day, and that's not emotional.
There's no doubt we can exhaust ourselves without really accomplishing anything.
And this fits into what insights have I had about emotional sobriety. And sometimes you have to look back to be to get this. But this year I was I'm still reading a book. It's called The Resilience Myth, New Thinking on Grit, Strength, and Growth After Trauma. And it reminded me of a study that was done in the 1970s on children with ACE, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And this was a longitudinal study. In fact, it was 32 years. They started in the 70s in Hawaii. They had almost 700 children who grew up in traumatic environments with alcoholism, with poverty, what have you. And they fully expected all of them to sort of underperform in life. But a third of them thrived. A third of them overcame their trauma. In fact, they had post-traumatic gains from it. They recognized in these kids that did well that they were able to problem solve, self-regulate, and envision a purposeful future. Now, that sounds like emotional sobriety to me. And it is true in recovery models, right? When you one of the things that made a difference for these kids, that despite the harmful life circumstances that they were suffering with, they had somebody. One person could make a difference, who was a good role model, who was supportive, who appreciated them no matter what they were going through. And that kind of pull helped these people get out of the quagmire. And when you look at the 15 chapters of emotional sobriety, you can see they're all sort of directions where if you're stuck here, or if you're sleepwalking, saying this is never going to change, this is, I'm doing the best I can, you know, think about these things, about, you know, how are my problem solving skills, can I self-regulate? That's a huge one for me. I was just so reactive to life for so long, and then the ability to have a sense of purpose from it. Many people say, I'm happy, I'm an addict. And people go, wow, you've been drinking too much of the Kool-Aid, pal. You know, maybe move on to a little reality here. But there's truth in that they are further ahead from having to suffer through and overcome addiction than they were beforehand. They weren't restored to something. They were lifted up from the experience. And I think that particular 32-year-long study, how long do we do that? Like, I remember thinking about that. That's so last century. But it really speaks to the impact of the sort of constant work. Yeah. And when I say work, it's just process, right? I don't feel burdened by my emotional sobriety work. It's I bring curiosity and positive regard to it.
To clarify things, Joe, so what differentiated the group of people that were thriving in that third, right, a third of the group, the difference between them is they had someone that had faith in them. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah.
That, that really it was
a combination of internal and external factors that were different for these kids than the ones who predictably sort of underachieved in life and you know had morbidity and mortality issues.
I remember when we were first doing a lot of the inner child work back in the last century, it's like that we just actually referred to these as angels. We're not meaning literal angels, but it's like people in your life. You find somebody comes from a really difficult situation. We included it in our interview. Who else was in their life? A neighbor, you know, an uncle, an aunt, somebody. And it turned out, and I didn't do any research with it, but it's like it didn't mean somebody had to be there all the time. It just needed, the person had to have some exposure to an alternate way of looking at things to know that there's another way is what that, at least that's my take on it. And it's like, and you can do that. And there's an internalization of that really is part, I'm sure it's not the explanation of it, but it's part of it, of how does that happen? Why does that one third of those people, you know, and by the way, I get that stuff about we'd be grateful for our addiction. It's like, I always often quote Michael J. Fox in his first book when he said, if somebody were to offer to take away my Parkinson's now, he said, I wouldn't give it to them. He said, I've gained way too much, you know? Yeah.
David Best reported out in a study he did with people post-treatment, post-rehab, and people who knew one person, at least one person, who was living in recovery had a 27% better chance of positive outcome rates, staying sober or clean. Just from knowing one person.
Well, and there's a little, it's interesting to examine what makes that work. It's like, and we can't know because it's individual for everybody, but it can be sort of mechanical in the sense of that through knowing this person, I've learned some things that I wouldn't have known before. But I really am a believer in maybe just studying my own crazy neurotic mind is that when you have an experience, not just knowledge, not just a theory, but when you have experience that demonstrates to you that something is possible.
Here it is. We must be willing to let go of the life we planned so as to have the life that is waiting for us.
So, see, this goes back to this whole discussion of expectations, doesn't it?
And always.
Core issue of emotional sobriety. In a moment, we're going to kind of review some of the things we've learned this year and that have deepened our understanding or in some way maybe even refined our understanding of emotional sobriety. But you know, it's back to this thing is that as soon as I have this idea, this schema of how things are supposed to be, it makes it difficult for me to appreciate what is. Because I get into comparison, right? In terms of it's supposed to be like this, not like this. And so what do I do with the difference between what I thought it was going to be like and what it is like now? And oftentimes, you know, that comes from my lack of faith in being able to deal with what is happening and be able to have. I can give you a great example. You guys know that I've been going through a lot of stuff with my divorce and the adjustment with my children and stuff like that. Maddie's 12 and CC's 7. And Maddie had a real tough time last year with it and stuff. And we got alienated and we spent a lot of time working through things, going to family therapy. She went to therapy and I was doing my work. She was doing her work. The family was doing their work. And we got back together. And when we got back together, you know, I asked her, what would you like to do to kind of celebrate our reunite, you know, our reunion, right? She said, take me to Paris. I want to see the Eiffel Tower.
That's a good ask. Yeah.
I said, you got, we're going. So
she was ready for that one.
Yeah. So we went, right? We went to Paris. And first couple of days, the first day we went to the Eiffel Tower. So that was it. I mean, that was just, she was so excited. She loved every minute of it. after we were there for about 3 days, she got really sick, man. Her fever just jumped up to about 104. And so all the other stuff that we had planned, these tours and stuff, I had to cancel a lot of them, right? Because then Cece got sick. Cece was, her temperature was even higher than Maddie's. Cece's. So for 3 days, I'm in the hotel room with them, nursing them rather than sightseeing Paris. And I thought to myself, you know, this is the gift of emotional sobriety, because there's be nothing that I'd be rather doing than showing these girls how much I love them by taking care of them and giving them the support that they need to get well over these next few days. And I said, and the fact that we can do that here and me not get lost in this whole thing about, oh, what a pity, this has ruined our vacation and all that other bullshit, that if I, you know, at one time in my life, I would have been that immature to be reacting that way and made their illness even more problematic, yeah. Right? Now they're bad about who they are. And it's not their fault. They got sick, right? Kind of a thing. So it was an incredible experience in terms of reviewing what we've learned is, my God, there is something to appreciate in whatever is happening if I really search for it. There is an opportunity for me to experience my life in a good way no matter what's happening. And see, that's the freedom, I think, that we're starting to discover here with emotional sobriety.
Well, you know, we talk about, I've been talking about categorization and measurement and stuff like that. What you just described is something that I remember referring to one time, is that maybe this is the nutshell in the making, but it's like we need to be able to lead our lives as if it's an essay question exam rather than a short answer or multiple choice, because that's what you just described. We're trying to figure out where does this fit? What to do that? It's like, just describe it. You know, I mean, that's what we do when we're talking about a client who's trying to put something into some words. We just say, just tell me what you feel like. Tell me what thoughts come to you. You know, in other words,
right. And what was the
raw material?
Yeah, and what was the trip really about? The trip was about making that intimate connection with, you know, your child that you've felt alienated from. And what was that not the best possible way to form that connection or, you know, strengthen it?
Patrick, see, that's the other thing that you're pointing out that I think is another thing we've been learning this last year, is that when we make things more important than people, we got trouble. We're going to create trouble in our lives. When I make an idea more important than my experience with the person, when I make a should more important, when I make a plan more important, I'll never forget. Dr. Kempler said something that I thought was brilliant at the time, but I can appreciate his wisdom in it even more now. He said, love cannot be a plan nor a commitment. And that flies in the face of what a lot of people would say. He says, love cannot be a plan or a commitment, but rather a result of who we are with each other. I mean, he really captured what we're talking about, is moving away from the objective and really moving much towards the personal or the subjective. And that's what you said, Patrick. That's what the experience I had. And you know, I'd give myself at least, you know, I felt good about how I showed up, you know, 99% of the time. I mean, it really was a gift. And I left that trip feeling great about the trip, you know, and so it is that opportunity of being able to show up to whatever is happening to us. That's why that statement from Campbell is so important.
In Islam, it's man makes plans, Allah laughs. Or John Lennon, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans.
Yeah, and I was looking for that John Lennon quote, but you got it.
Yeah.
All right.
My word for the year is being. And what being isn't is control, like needing to control my environment to feel safe, to feel okay, right? Just be. That allows you to embrace the moment with your ailing daughters to say, this is what heals alienation, you know, connecting as parent and child. Nothing could do it better. And what a beautiful environment to do it in, right? And you were so smart to do the Eiffel Tower first.
Yes.
And for me, I have a tendency, and I've done it this year, to say, well, this is who I am. This is what's true for me. This is how it is. And that is an intellectual need to control and command. I don't want to think about that anymore. I've decided this is the true me. And I'm not there. I don't need to be fixed, but I may be fixed. I don't need to grow, but I may grow. I don't need to look at things completely different, but I'm open to it. That's what I want to try to do.
It's the difference between, you're choosing between ego and spirit. It's like, you know, our ego just always wants that definition, you know, and we want the specific goals. We want this kind of stuff. We want to know how to measure how we're doing in any given moment. And fear always comes from ego. And what we're all talking about is just simply being, and to use Joe's word, is to being in the experience, period. That's it. Just being there. The thing that comes to my mind is the thing you and I used to talk about more on the podcast, Alan, was positive opportunism. You know, living according to the question, what can I do with what's happening today to help me to be a better person? And by the way, it's an essay question.
That's right.
It's not a short answer.
Everybody throw out at least two things, maybe three things that you think that you've really come into focus, a clearer focus this last year about emotional sobriety.
Recovery is a long continuum. And on that long continuum, you lose sometimes. There are losses and there is pain. And something about Rob Reiner's murder that happened a couple weeks ago here in Los Angeles, I get the rose-colored glasses on about the recovery and, you know, emotional sobriety must accommodate the darkness. And it's not a pessimism, I wouldn't say, but it's a it's an awareness that you know, you're kind of keeping your eye on the long term, and that you know, like Cornel West always says that hope is a verb. You know, it's something that, you know, you take action to foster in yourself and other people. And I think, you know, recovery is too. It's, you know, it's you got to keep putting gas into it wherever you can get it. And an emotional sobriety is about keeping that your feet on the ground throughout that process.
I am altering my view of resilience. And this really speaks to what both of you have gone through, probably all three of you. Tom hasn't gone yet. But I sometimes overly simplify resilience, that it's about being positive, that emotional sobriety is being in a good mood, that emotional sobriety is being in control and, you know, a leader. And this year, I understand that it is, you know, to be well adjusted to an unhealthy environment is not emotional sobriety. That there's a time for depression. There is a time for anger. There is a time for all of the whole range of emotion. And that's obvious to a lot of people. But for me, you know, that sort of trying to live my life from the neck up, you know, keeping it logical, keeping it in control, I'm missing most of life. And this year I've touched that a little bit by, you know, pausing, looking, you know, saying, when I come up with a great idea, I go, well, that's really good, Joe. What else could this mean? And being open to other ways of seeing things.
Good point. Well, the other thing about the feeling being open, you know, that's not just about happy. It's like which is so important. So important. It's like, and we just get we've been fooled into thinking that's the ultimate goal. And I'm always wanting to point out, I'm a fan of happy. You guys know I am. I like to have fun. I like things to be. But that's not the point. And when you said about having the feelings, the thing that popped in my head is, yeah, have the feelings and not be defined by the feelings. You know, feelings, it goes back to, I mean, there's so much of this stuff that just goes back to the stuff that we've been teaching from the beginning. It's, you know, one of the first chapters in my first book was about emotional flow. You know, the point that, you know, not an earth shattering insight here. It's like the idea that about getting in our own way. It's like our emotions simply want to flow through us. That's it. It's like our digestive system. They only become toxic if we block them. If we try to do something with them that, you know, they're not designed to do. Have the emotions. Don't make them define. You know, I can have anger. I can have lots of anger. I don't have to be an angry person.
I've got a lot of anger. Yeah. But I don't. I hope people don't describe me as an angry person.
Well, you
I
can always, also
I think about that when I'm angry.
Now I'm being you know, picky with language right now. But you could, if we're being precise with that, we're saying a lot of anger flows through me. You know, rather than, yes, than of, I have a lot of anger, because our even our language basically is an affirmation for us to hold on to it.
Yeah.
You know, I have anger. Here it is. It's like no, it's here comes some more anger.
Well, Tom, yeah. you got to give us yours.
Accurate, say anger has me. You know, it's like
that's what it feels like. Absolutely, that's what the experience is.
Anger, my special friend.
I don't know how this categorizes, but well, for that it makes sense. It doesn't categorize because, as you guys know, what I've been really attracted to in the last few months, especially, is just looking at the possible. How could we possibly begin to speak a language and think in a language that is not based on measurement and categorization? It's like, you know, and I told you guys at the outset that basically, you know, it's so much a part of our culture and of how we have grown up being. It's like, I don't know how to talk about the subject without actually practicing the problem, categorizing and measuring things. It's like, but it is about raw.
Do you mean by that? I was just going to ask about the categorization and measurement. Is that doing so stifles our understanding of what we're actually experiencing?
It stops us from pure experience.
Can you give me an example real quick, Tom? Okay, was there a time that really sticks out where your measurement was wrong and that the your realization that it was wrong? No.
The previous 69 years, I think. I mean, we're not good at measurement. I mean, it's like we can't do it in the present moment. I'm distracted from your question. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. The measurement was wrong. But then in realizing its wrongness, you kind of understood that there was something deeper.
It's so hard because to say the measurement was wrong is to be measuring. You see, I'm stuck in it. Rather than that, you know, I have anger coming through me. You know, it's like one of my experiences with what's going on in the world is I feel fear just flowing through me. Sometimes I just feel just enraged about this thing. It's like, okay, but as long as what I'm describing is moving, this is what I think I'm learning about is emotional sobriety. Maybe I can categorize it this way. It's like, as long as it's moving, I think I'm alive. I'm being alive as opposed to stopping it, you know, and because that's what we do with anger. I've learned that in doing therapy with people. You know, people, of all the emotions we store up, anger is the one we store up the most. And the reason for that is because anger is the feeling that we're more uncomfortable with. So what do? We collect the one that we are most uncomfortable with instead of letting it flow through. It's like, you know,
that's so counterintuitive.
It's totally backwards. It's like, so I gather up all this anger and hold on to it because I don't understand it, because I'm scared of it, because I have stories about it that make it even scarier. And it's like, and the resolution is let it go. And that didn't mean make it go away. It just means let it go. Let it move. And as you and we know, when we feel things, if you're feeling something intensely, one of the things we know is that in the next period of time, or maybe within the next minute, you're not going to be feeling the same thing you're feeling right now, because that's the nature of emotion. That's the nature of being alive and movement. It's like, but what we do is we hold on to it.
I wanted to go back to the question that we have, Patrick, about what did we learn this last year? And there's a few things that stand out that I want to highlight before we run out of time here today. So one of the things that I think was a very important extension of our thinking this last year is we talked about I'm okay if a lot. Is that's the consciousness that gets us in trouble. And that consciousness is a result of not that we're sick, we're stuck. We're just stuck in that it's an all about me world. And right, that's where we have a growth disorder, not a psychiatric disorder. We're stuck in our development. So this is a developmental issue. It's not a psychiatric issue. So that's why Bill talked about his failure to grow up when he talked about the letter. And we see that. The extension that Tom made this last year that I thought was a very good addition to the emotional sobriety discussion, it's not just that I'm okay if, but I'd be okay if this didn't happen to me. So it got extended from I'm okay if, and the addition was I would be okay if this didn't happen to me. And see, it's the same thing.
Or I'm okay even though it did happen to me.
What we want to get to is that's what, you know, you brought in today, Joe, is that it can be, and I'm okay even though this happened to me. Now, you know, those people that aren't as fortunate to have that experience early on in the life to have someone to believe in them, it's still a possibility. I mean, I think that I my experience with my sponsor is a testimony to that. I think a lot of us have had someone who believed in us. I think my relationship with you, Patrick, is one of those things, is I've had a lot of faith in you and I believe in you and I see who you really are, man. I just see what a wonderful person you are. And I think that that's meant a lot to you through these years that we've been together. So I think that stuff that you talked about is important. The other thing that I think was really important is to understand that this is a growth disorder. That's very important, right? It takes us off this hook about worrying about what's wrong with me and focusing on what's right about me that I just got to get. It's like I'm thinking of emotional sobriety as reigniting our developmental sequence. It reignites it. It reinstates it. It reinstates our developmental process that got frozen because of all of these ideas we have about who we're supposed to be, how the culture defines us. I'm starting to get into French philosopher Foucault. And he talks about, you know, how people become subjects, meaning what happens in our society that defines a person as a human being. And you just see, he talks about shoulds is what he's talking about, all these rules and ideas. And the rules and ideas that our culture give us are not very helpful. They are not navigating ourselves in this world. So that's been another, to me, an important revelation this last year. The other thing is that passing on this word can make a big difference. When people start to hear about this, I just got an incredible note from somebody in Gibraltar the other day and said, You can't believe what's happened in our recovery community since you started to bring in this discussion of emotional sobriety. It's changed the whole depth of the community. And see, we can make a difference. And we are making a difference. And that's been very exciting for me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to sign off for a minute because I got to go say goodbye to someone, you guys. Happy New Year, everyone. I love you guys.